Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 8th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Digby from the blog Hullabaloo, or Heather Parton from the website salon.com, will be here to look back on the week that was and continues to be. Also, special guest running for public advocate, hot off her performance in the debate two nights ago. She did great. Nomiki Konst will call in. And then, still on the road. I think the last time we talked to him was like 3 or 4 weeks ago. He was on the road. Film guy Matthew, who apparently is just living the life of luxury. Of what? Road guy Matthew. Also on the program today, 5 to 4, Roberts votes with the liberals against the Louisiana trap law. But Susan Collins has some explaining to do as Brett Kavanaugh writes to the dissent, which would have effectively gutted Roe v. Wade. Meanwhile, Bezos outs Pecker's plan to blackmail him as the Trump National Enquirer scandal thickens. Supreme Court makes a move to say Islam not a real religion.
Thank you.
Yeah. And rest in peace, John Dingell. Leaves us at age 92. Got in some very good shots at Donald Trump before he left, but also
did
not leave to see his dream of health care in the way that he wanted, but certainly some progress. Trump seeks, or I should say, seats another 44 right-wing judges, and the Green New Deal slammed by the Trumpistas as being too ambitious. Turns out Paul Manafort is either a pathological liar or he has something to hide.
The third option. All of the above.
Or both. Trump mad that Adam Schiff is a better boss than he is. And Attorney General Stooge Matthew Whitaker testifies to the House Judicial Committee. And finally, Trump reverses the Obama-era payday loan restrictions. So congratulations, folks. You still have the opportunity to be subject to predatory loans that will drive you into a financial ditch. Just a reminder, this program relies on its members to exist week in, week out, day in, day out. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, not only do we give you our heartfelt thanks, we also give you extra content every single day, nearly. Almost every single day. But always we provide you the show commercial-free, although some people complain about that, but you can check out our deals that we have on our website now. It's all been
one of the more unusual complaints that we get.
Well, the commercials sometimes can be fun, and also there's some, frankly, good deals.
Yes.
Go to Joybird, get 25% off. I'm eyeing that one big time.
That's a good one.
There's maybe a nice chair I may get there. Anyways, I don't want to get any free plugs, but
You just did.
Well, I did. I also got a really nice note that I was going to save for when we're doing a Harry's, but apparently somebody uses the body wash and they really like it. Gulag Greg.
Gulag Greg uses the body
wash. So you can become a
That's
member.
That's the best endorsement I've ever heard as a product.
They should put that.
So, Gulag Greg endorsed. So you can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Two clips before we bring in Digby. This one from the State of the Union. I was trying to express this the other day as we were doing our, you know, we pre-recorded the intro to Wednesday's show because Thursday night got pretty late and involved a lot of alcohol. And I was trying to communicate how much Donald Trump did not seem to be connected to the words he was saying and the idea that he had clearly only read the speech maybe once. And I think nothing captures that more than his inability to differentiate between these two ideas. They just seem to be all words that he's reading. They have no meaning whatsoever. And here is this short clip to illustrate that point.
All children, born and unborn, are made in the holy image of God. The final part of my agenda is to protect American security.
The Nancy Pelosi's face is just sort of precious. She's like, wait, what?
We were saying earlier that she's basically breaking in new sinew in her face with how incredulous she is.
Start it over because this is how it should be delivered.
All children, born and unborn, are made in the holy image of God, the final part of my agenda.
Okay, pause it. So it was supposed to be all children are made in the holy image of God.
New paragraph.
The final part of my agenda is national security. That's supposed to be what happened. But because he's not conscious of he has no attachment to these words, he is literally reading this as if English was a second or third language to him. He's good at he has no idea what the words mean. And he's just reading them off with no intonation because, again, he doesn't realize, new thought.
They can edit it better.
They could fix it post.
That's how I read ads.
Exactly. Razor's good.
Razors are good. The final part is the code.
No, you can't even do it. You can't even do it. You can't even. It's almost impossible to just off the top of your head, yeah, because it goes against all of the things that we know when we get attached to language. But all right, here's another clip. This is pretty good. Do we have people should check our Instagram thing. John Benjamin and Larry Murphy made a great graphic that we put up on our Instagram account. You know we have an Instagram account now. Did you know that, Matt?
I was aware, yeah.
It is, and we retitled it. It's The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. Our Instagram specialist was...
I saw the Instagram specialist came in and cleaned house a little
yes,
bit.
Yes, they did. If you head over there now it's a little bit cleaner, and each little morsel of Instagram is precious. We don't... But it's a very funny graphic that shows ostensibly a Fox News poll. Those who oppose taxing people over 10 million, those in favor, 70%. Those against, well, you'll have to find out. That's a little tease. But meanwhile, here is, this is clip number what that you have up there? Oh, this is Maria Bartiromo, and she is on Fox News with Shannon Bream, that's her name, and Bill Hemmer. Is Hemmer sleepy today?
I don't know if sleepy's the
euphemism.
He's a little bit less loosey goosey today.
Okay, okay. He's all right. Sometimes he gets a little bit. He has a real demeanor change these days. Anyways, here they are. They're talking about, you know, why you shouldn't tax wealthy people on their wealth.
Here's the headline, Wall Street Journal. New Democratic agenda sure looks like government control over the means of production. So they went through Medicare for All, endorsed by 16 other senators. Kamala Harris had the line last week, let's eliminate all that, meaning the employer insurance.
Yeah, because the
new Green Deal, endorsed by 40 House Democrats, guaranteed government job for all. Kirsten Gillibrand has tweeted in support of that. Vastly higher taxes. It's now being debated in the House Ways and Means Committee to raise taxes even higher. There's some of the headlines from that.
Yeah, exactly. And when you're looking at Medicare for All, it's actually, as James Freeman says all the time, Medicare for None, because you're replacing private health insurance companies with a new self-payer, one-payer government assistance Medicare program. So that's, of course, that's socialism. And then
pause it. Wait a second. But I'm not clear on why it's Medicare for None.
Or why it's self-payer.
Because it's like it's just like Venezuela.
I get it now. Chicago politics.
So that's, of course, that's socialism. And then the Green Deal. You know, this is an idea where the government is in charge and the government is allocating resources to individuals. Everybody has the same. What does that do for productivity? We talked about that in the past. You know, why would you want to work really hard to think that you can, in fact, achieve success if you know that no matter what you do, it's all the same as the next person?
It's hard to believe. And that Wall Street Journal piece also.
Pause it. You know, this is an interesting theory because we have seen worker productivity rise so exponentially over the past 30 years or so that 40 years that the minimum wage is about, if it followed productivity, would be somewhere in the low 20s an hour. So this concept of, and these are people, I got news for you, they would never be in danger of paying the top marginal tax rate as they work. Yet their productivity continues to go up. Maybe that's why, because they're not afraid of paying the top marginal tax rate.
Same as the next person.
It's hard to believe. And that Wall Street Journal piece also took on Elizabeth Warren's proposed wealth tax and said this. Ms. Warren wants a new 2% wealth tax on assets over $50 million and 3% over $1 billion, including assets held abroad. France recently junked its wealth tax because it was so counterproductive. And such a tax has never been levied in America. This is government confiscation merely because someone has earned or saved more money than someone else. Socialism.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. I love the way they wrote that, actually. And it's true. It is confiscation. Because the truth is you could work your whole life, work really hard, achieve success, make money, and then get it taken away, confiscated by the government. These policies oftentimes lead to unintended consequences where people will actually see that they're being overtaxed, see that their money is being confiscated, and they will come up with various structures to hide income. And so at the end of the day, the government's not getting that revenue anyway. I'm talking about...
Now, you know what's amazing about this? Here he is. She's a business news, right? And she is conflating wealth and income. Like, they're going to hide their income because of a wealth tax. No, they would hide their income, like they do now, because of an income tax, which we also incidentally have. A wealth tax... I guess she's arguing that they'll hide their income. Well, the wealth, as long as we can see the wealth, or at least part of it, we'll get 2% of that wealth.
I'd be happy to take a much more aggressive punitive approach to that as well. So if the issue that she's concerned about is like lack of regulatory authority and investigative powers by the IRS to get that money, I think we could take care of that too.
Tough on crime.
Yeah. I'm tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime.
Is there another area where they're like, oh, people might not follow these laws, therefore these laws shouldn't exist?
Why would,
like,
you have three strikes laws? About... People still shoplift.
Exactly.
Ooh, I would actually, maybe what we really need to do is bring in the ATF for this. Forget about the IRS. Let's just get the hardcores.
Or SEAL Team 6.
will actually see that they're being overtaxed, see that they're being, their money is being confiscated, and they will come up with various structures to hide income. And so at the end of the day, the government's not getting that revenue anyway. I'm talking about legal structures in some ways, where people will try their hardest to change the way their income is measured. And that's one of the unintended consequences.
It will clearly be an issue during the primary for the Democratic campaign.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
All these candidates are going to be asked about it, where they stand.
Exactly.
I saw a Business Network yesterday afternoon. It was not Fox Business. Mm. The banner on the screen said attacking socialism.
Attacking socialism.
Attacking socialism with the president's face behind it, say the union. Now, segment was
as
a lot better
that's
than
a bad thing.
Well, I took a double take.
A double take?
Hold on, I took a double take.
No, no, he didn't take a double take. He took a double take. Can we just go back on that? I mean, no, this is getting petty here, but I just want to
say the union. Now, segment was
as
a lot better
that's
than
a bad thing.
Well, I took a double take.
There, he is so scared of socialism, he can't even talk right now. It's great.
Could
socialism come in a bottle?
Well, maybe. Why does he drink?
Well, there you have it. It is pretty funny though to hear them like read this off as if like they're almost like holding back laughter. And it just doesn't match up with the words when they're saying, like, proposing a 2% tax on wealth over $50 million.
I think if it went for too much longer, they'd probably start crying.
Well,
I know what they say. We laugh to keep from crying.
Of course. But when they deliver their stuff and they're attempting to make it sound bad and stupid, it can't help but resonate with people who just go, I'm not sure what's so funny about 2% on 50 million. Is that going to be?
They're relying on tone of voice to make the argument.
Exactly. All right. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby. My boss is a proper bubble. Put me as a Nissan scrub above her. Do it right, receive the lion's share, bliss. No, I'll do it just for the right time. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program a regular Friday guest, ladies and gentlemen, who inspired this little ditty. Are you ready for some pee-pee? Digby, how are you?
Hey, I'm fine. I'm ready.
You're ready. Now I know you've been watching. You've been watching the Whitaker hearings, and we were watching this beforehand. Just give us a brief update. What's happening up to this point with Whitaker? Jerry Nadler has been rather. I guess he has towed the line in this instance, right? Whitaker was saying that he wasn't going to show up unless he was promised that there would be no subpoena. But the first thing, and so Nadler said, as long as you answer, there'll be no subpoena. And when he got here, when he got to the committee, shortly after it was clear he was sort of stonewalling, Nadler said, you know what, we could subpoena you. Because you're not really holding up your end of the bargain. That was pretty. I was pretty happy with that. But what's happened since then?
Well, since then, as far as I know, I haven't watched for the last 10 minutes or so. But prior to that, it was pretty clear that Whitaker. I mean, he had obviously been prepped for this and was prepped with some sort of wooden halting answers that were designed to say, you know, I will not, you know, discuss my private conversations. And he didn't explicitly. Evoke executive privilege or that weird Jeff Sessions and Steve Bannon and the rest of them who had evoked. And one of the things that Nadler was trying to do was to sort of deal with the fact that they have been in the 2 years prior coming up to the Hill and evoking this weird privilege that doesn't exist. In other words, just saying, well, I'm not going to say anything because the president might want to evoke executive privilege in the future. That's not how it works. The president has to do it. It's his privilege, and he has to say, you know, no, you're not allowed to talk about this. That's executive privilege. So they've been trying to change that, and I think that Nadler, a lot of this thing around Whitaker and this particular, you know, sort of controversy that's been going back and forth. I don't know if people have followed it over the last few days, but Nadler had, you know, obviously Whitaker had been stalling and trying not to actually have to make this appearance before he left, before William Barr was confirmed. But they were unable to do it. So he ended up having to come up. And what Nadler had done back in January was sent up a series of questions, say, I'm giving you these questions in advance so that you can ask the president if he wants to invoke executive privilege. If he does, then you have to let us know 48 hours in advance so that we can properly prepare the committee. That's reasonable. Well, they ignored it, or he forgot or something. But in any case, he didn't respond. And so Nadler said that, you know, they decided to hold a vote in the committee as to whether or not they would subpoena him if he decided not to show up at all, which was entirely possible. The way they were acting was that Whitaker was just going to blow off the hearing. They'd put in Barr, and that would, you know, allegedly be the end of that. And Nadler was having none of it. So they went through this subpoena battle back and forth over the idea that, you know, he was either going to comply or they were going to start using the sanctions that they have available to them as the oversight, as the congressional oversight, and that they were going to subpoena him. Well, they went back and forth until the end of the day yesterday. Finally, it was agreed upon that he would not subpoena him if he came down to the Hill, answered the questions, and then, as you say, this is what's happened this morning. So they're continuing the hearing, but from what I understood, and I may be wrong about this, Nadler said, look, you know, we're going to have you come back and do a deposition, and then we'll release that, you know, under oath, and then we'll release that deposition to the public. So I don't think this is over, and I think you're right that Nadler's not playing, and neither are the rest of the committees in the Congress. They're not playing. They are absolutely going to press this stuff, and as I've been watching Whitaker this morning, I mean, this is just, he's just saying, he didn't invoke executive privilege, he's just saying, I'm not going to talk about this. He's saying, I'm refusing to talk about this stuff. I don't talk about ongoing investigations, which would be fair enough normally, but he did do it in a press conference the other day. And he also said that, you know, he's also saying that he won't discuss his private conversations with the president, which to me indicates that he had them in some respect or another. So that's where we are today on this. And, you know, the guy's just a dolt. He has absolutely no business being in this position at all.
Let me just ask a broader question about executive privilege. So what my understanding is, what they've basically been saying is that we've developed a new form of executive privilege, which is the anticipatory executive privilege, right? Because executive privilege is just specifically where the president, president invokes executive privilege. There, nobody in the cabinet can invoke an executive privilege. They don't have it. They can only communicate to the committee. The president has invoked executive privilege on this particular manner. And so what Sessions did, and I'm reiterating what you said just to make sure that I understand it too. What Sessions et al. Did was like, I think the president would invoke, might want to invoke executive privilege for this. So I'm invoking an anticipatory executive, an anticipatory privilege associated with me about what I would anticipate the president would do with him. And that doesn't exist. That's a made up thing. What is it about the president invoking executive privilege? I mean, my understanding is all it is it's just the president invoked executive privilege and the president has a reason not to talk about it. Is it just that politically it's associated with stuff so much from Nixon that it's toxic? I mean, like, I don't quite understand the salience of this, because it seems nobody cares about norms anyways.
Well, I agree with you that nobody cares about norms anyways, and certainly the administration doesn't care. I mean, they have no respect for norms or even, you know, constitutionally required congressional oversight. I mean, clearly they just don't care about any of that. But and I am no expert on this, so forgive me, all you lawyers and experts out there, if you're listening, if I get this wrong. But my understanding is that executive privilege does obviously exist. But it's never truly been litigated all the way. The reason we know it exists is because the Supreme Court agreed that it existed in the Nixon tapes case, but there were exceptions. And from what I understand from, you know, just what I've seen by TV lawyers who talk about this, that it's not just something you can just blanket, you know, that you would expect that you could just blanketly invoke whenever you don't want to talk about something. In other words, the president has to have a good reason for it. National security, or some kind of, you know, they want, you know, unfettered advice from their staff, and they wouldn't be able to get that if they had to talk about these things. In other words, it's not just a blanket sort of privilege that the president can invoke whenever he wants to. However, none of this stuff has been litigated, and my personal feeling is that I think that Nadler understands that they are about to go into some serious litigation over this stuff. There is going to be a point at which it's going to go to court, and that we're going to start seeing the courts involved in that particular question of executive privilege. And it's not because Nadler necessarily wants it to be, but because they have used these weird excuses and have refused to do the proper process in invoking the privilege. I mean, the president, for reasons that I don't understand, is refusing to do that, or at least maybe they've decided that they're going to, you know, I mean, look, you've got some real extremist sort of lawyers on the Republican side who may have decided that they believe in unfettered executive power, that maybe they've decided that they're just going to take this all the way and say the president never has to talk about anything he doesn't want to talk about ever, because he's the executive and it's his privilege to not say anything. And they're just going on the assumption that the American people, or at least the American people they care about, are fine with that. So, I mean, that's my guess on that Nadler and the rest of the people on the Judiciary Committee understand that this is just a beginning, and they're setting up a series of probable confrontations because they know this is going to be litigated down the road. I mean, I could be wrong. I'm just guessing on that, but that's how it looks to me. I mean, this all seems very kind of it's thought out on the Democratic side for sure, that they've been plotting this knowing that they were going to be coming up against as much, you know, possible resistance as they could get. So I think
right.
They've been setting this up.
And let's get this resolved as early in the in the proceedings as possible, because there's only going to be more stuff. You know, in some ways, they're like, okay, let's just address the process issues early, so that we can continue on with these investigations. And there are multiple ones, obviously. And we should say, the investigations range. I mean, if there was no Mueller investigation, right, there would be still a record-breaking number of needed investigations from just the sheer sort of, I don't know if I would call it graft or corruption that has existed so far in the Trump administration. Each cabinet member seems to have had their own sort of uniquely impressive corruption scandal, which is
very
also
impressive.
Which we also saw this week, which was sort of fascinating. And, you know, I think so much of this stuff gets sort of rolled into the Russia investigations. But presuming there was no question of, you know, whether there was Russian collusion or whether, you know, all the lying that's gone on and all et cetera, the money laundering that probably happened under the Trump administration, the under the Trump Trump Inc. This week, the Southern District of New York, just the U.S. Attorney's Office opened up an investigation into the Trump inauguration, because there was so much money raised for so little delivered. And I think, and I'm curious what you can tell us about why the Southern District of New York would have jurisdiction over this. The other question I have is, it seems to me that it's got to have something to do with that huge amount of money paid to a consultant who is a friend of Melania's. But it could be anything, right?
Well, I think it's all tied up with, well, let me just say this. I'm not sure why it's in the Southern District of New York. You'd have to ask somebody who understands the way those jurisdictions work. But my assumption is, as a layperson, that this has something to do with the Trump Organization, which is in New York. And that there is, I read a very interesting piece this morning on the Daily Beast by Barbara McQuaid, former prosecutor, U.S. attorney, and I think she's from Michigan. In any case, she's on TV a lot, and people who watch these shows probably recognize her. But she had a very interesting take on that, on this, on the inauguration and some of the other stuff, because we also learned this week that the Southern District has been interviewing members of the Trump Organization. So we don't know if that's connected or whether there's something else or whether or not this is one case or, you know, many cases. But her theory is that this is actually has the contours of a RICO investigation. And RICO is the Racketeering Act, which was created back in 1970, mostly as a way to try and get to the mob, because what they had done was organize themselves in such a way as to insulate the big bosses from any kind of criminal exposure. So they had to find a way to do it, and they created this law, which, you know, as a civil libertarian, you know, I've often thought, boy, this is really reaching. But in this case, it may be the only way that they can do this, or at least using the premise of the, you know, the sort of RICO concept of how you put together a conspiracy, that conspiracy case, that you know, this may be the way that they're going about this. And this is where it has to do with the inauguration, which has to do with the Trump Organization, and the fact, which, you know, getting to your back to your original point, if there were no Mueller investigation, the mere fact that the President of the United States refused to divest himself of his business and put it into a blind trust or do something other than just say, well, my boys are in charge and, you know, I'm leaving it up to them, would be cause for a tremendous amount of investigation and theoretically a criminal investigation as well, because it's not just a constitutional problem with the emoluments. There's obviously been pay to play, which is what we're looking at with this inauguration situation. We've got massive amounts of money that were raised. It really appears, just judging from this person that you mentioned who was Melania's friend who ran it, it may actually be that she winds up being a big whistleblower on this thing, because it was just revealed that there are tapes between her and Michael Cohen that were picked up during the raid on Michael Cohen's offices, in which she's talking about her own misgivings about the way this money was spent and how she had tried to bring it up and was told to keep it quiet. And then, you know, you've got Rick Gates, who is the Manafort's you know, Major Domo, who has been cooperating with Mueller and, you know, maybe cooperating with the Southern District of New York as well, because that's he was on the inauguration committee. And so all of this money was churning around. He raised like twice as much as Obama's in 2008. And we know the results. It wasn't like, you know, they had a lavish ceremony or anything. So that money went someplace, and there were there's all these, you know, foreign, in, you know, apparent, you know, kind of a slush fund of foreign investors in there. I mean, it's quite an ugly thing. And then all those tentacles come into the Trump organization. Then, you know, they come back out into the Mueller investigation, and all of this is intertwined. So, you know, this is a very this is the kind of situation, conspiracy sort of situation, where you could see the RICO statute kind of being put to use to try and put the whole thing together.
I am convinced, and this is based on nothing, I should say, or very little, but I'm just, the whole thing sounds to me like, and again, like a, this is a complete speculation, that this was a way of funneling money to Melania. Like, I'm sure there was other things that they were doing this, but when her best friend or her friend is getting gets literally like 20, was it $25 million for a consulting fee? That sounds like to me a backdoor way of paying off Melania. Like, I'm sorry that I won the president's. Like, I, you know, all the reporting was she was extremely mad. And something's got, you know, like the idea that her best friend is brought in and then is just sort of like shuttled away. That's just sounds to me like, you know, these are all professional money launderers. And,
right, exactly.
And so the idea of like, you know, this is the way we, this is the way we deal with things. We money comes in one end, we give it out another end. We make sure that it's not traceable in some fashion.
Right.
I mean, and this seems to be fairly straightforward. The Southern District of New York is going to be able to follow that money, it seems to me, fairly easily, right? Like, it goes into your bank account, then let's we'll find out where it goes after that. Maybe someplace in the Cayman Islands would be my guess. but it's going to be pretty pretty nuts, I think, once we start to dig into that. And again, this is an investigation that, if it was just that, this, right? If it was just this, it seems like that would be a huge, huge scandal. But it's
well, think about this. You know, Trump said yesterday, he woke up on the wrong side of the bed yesterday morning and accidentally watched MSNBC and heard that Adam Schiff was, you know, hiring some people, you know, for, that had once worked in the White House National Security Council,
yes.
And he heard this story, and he was completely freaked out, and he, you know, did his usual tweet tantrum. And in the course, in that tweet tantrum, he said, this has never happened before. No president has ever been investigated like this. This is outrageous. This is, you know, disgusting, et cetera, et cetera. And we know how he feels. You know, he's a whiner. Maybe the most, you know, vociferous whiner in world history. And so he was really upset. And the idea that he, you know, he's there have been investigations his entire adult life, starting with Richard Nixon and his abuse of power and corruption, all the way through to Benghazi. Every single decade, there have been, you know, there's a Iran-Contra, and of course there was Clinton, which the Whitewater case was about some, you know, crappy land deal from the 1980s, from, you know, decades before that was worth, you know, $30,000. They spent years and years investigating that. And he's acting like nobody's ever done this before. Well, you know, they need to look in the mirror because, of course, it's been done before. And by the way, the people who, you know, have really been crooks in all this were, you know, were the Republicans. Clinton turned out to be just, you know, some, it was all kind of penny ante gothic Arkansas nonsense. And, you know, Benghazi, my God, they spent, you know, years on that for absolutely no good reason. So, you know, he needs to stop complaining and recognize that, you know, he apparently didn't take this into consideration before he ran for president. That, you know, if you're a criminal and you're running a criminal enterprise, maybe not a good idea.
Well,
to put yourself under this kind of scrutiny, because it was always going to happen.
He may have also, I mean, to be fair, he also may have thought, I'm never going to win.
True.
And so no one's going to levy this type of scrutiny. I think there's two things going on. I think it's one, he didn't think he was going to win, and so he didn't think he'd be subject to the scrutiny. And two, I think this is sort of the Kavanaugh principle. It's like, hey, wait a second. I am now part of a class of people who don't have to, are my forebears did not get held accountable. This is not fair. That's what that like. This is a loss of privilege for me, and I should not be held to this level of account. I feel like is part of it. All right, but let's also just turn to this other thing that's sort of fascinating. So Jeff Bezos, I guess it was yesterday, takes to Medium and writes a letter to the world, basically saying that he got contacted by the folks at National Enquirer who are concerned about the investigations the Washington Post is doing into the relationship between the Enquirer and the Saudis and the Trump administration, and basically said, we have dick pics of you that you took and your girlfriend, and boy, it would really suck for you for them to get out into the public. Maybe we should meet in the context of all the stuff that you're pursuing, you know, in terms of chasing us down. And Bezos basically said, I'm the richest guy in the world and I live in my own universe. And so I don't care what pics you have of my penis. I am going to out you. And that's what happened. And I don't know. For me, the really fascinating part was how much he talks about Saudi Arabia in this mm-hmm. piece, right? Like it just, that seems like a little bit of a bank shot, but it's as if he is, it's his way of threatening them, like with like, look, I want you just to be aware. We're much closer to finding some connections that you may not have thought of. And we're going to put it out there right now. This is the way that we leak stuff out there.
Oh, absolutely. There are a lot of rumors to that effect that the Post has some kind of information. You know, I mean, they were the employers of Khashoggi. I mean, that, you know, they were, and they've been truly, I think, the people at the Post who worked with him, I think they had, and reporters in general, but especially at the Post, but were just completely appalled by what happened, and also the fact that you know, Trump and Jared Kushner, who apparently was helping MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, you know, with his damage control on the story, was calling him up and saying, hey, let me help you out here. They're truly appalled and offended by this. And so they've been pursuing this. And at the same time, I think that Bezos hired, you know, one of the country's most, you know, well-known private investigators. What's his name? Gavin De Becker, I think. Excuse me. Out in Hollywood, you know, he's very well known as a, you know, super top investigator. And, I think I'm not surprised that Bezos would hire him. And he's also been on this. And, there, of course, Bezos was sending a shot across the bow there, which is kind of like, hey, you know, are you sure you want to go here? Are you sure you want to mess with this? And I think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that I don't think Bezos cares about his dick pics. You know, he's the richest man in the world. You know, whatever. You know, and
you
frankly,
can buy an unlimited amount
else,
of penises,
you know?
After that, or exactly. Yes, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, who cares? You know, and I, you know, none of us care about dick pics at this point. It's
right.
Like, you know, what we've seen one dick pic, we've seen them all, right? So, you know, this is no big deal. And the fact that Bezos, you know, is extremely powerful in terms of his wealth and in terms of the fact that he owns the Washington Post, you know, I think that he's decided to use that power that he has as a billionaire, or excuse me, as Howard Schultz says, a man of means.
Right.
That he's going to use that to try and push this. And use his power for good in this one respect. I mean, I'm not trying to give him a pass on all the rest of it, but in this case, and I mean, hey, you know, this is a really you know, interesting tactic on Bezos' part, because, I mean, when I was in the second, or I guess it was the sixth grade, Charlie Adcock caught a note that I'd sent to a friend in which I called the teacher a bitch. And he blackmailed me for it and was saying that he was going to tell her and I had to give him money and do all that. So I took the note to the teacher.
Hold on 1 second. We just got to note that breaking news. We just broke some news there. Go ahead.
About Charlie Adcock?
Yeah, right. The whole story.
Right. I know. It's a big one. Really, really interesting. But I'm just saying that this is one way to deal with blackmailers, right? Which is just take it upon yourself to just sort of go and admit that the thing happened. And in the end, the blackmailer often looks way worse for doing what he did. So I think that's what his approach is here. And I think, you know, he's done himself some good, too. I mean, the dick pics are the least of it, right? I mean, at this point, we may be talking about an international incident that could reflect very, very badly on the Inquirer, and also on this, you know, the Inquirer has been doing this with Trump's enemies for a long time, right? I mean, this came out during the Cohen thing. I mean, we knew that Pecker was called up to Trump Tower when Trump decided to run for president, and Trump said, "So how can you help me with this campaign?" And Pecker said, "Well, let's see what we can do here." So, I mean, the idea that there's a political overlay here, that perhaps he was also helping out his friend Trump, is also a big part of this.
Yeah, and I mean, more and more, it sort of feels like there's this group of guys who are friends who are just like, we're going to get in on this deal. And there's all these, like, you know, it sort of reminds me of, I can't, his name escaped, was it Collins? Who was the congressman who was like getting insider information for stocks? And who's it, Collins? And was just like, I've made four millionaires in Congress. You know, they're all rich because of me. Like, it's
what?
Like all the money just sort of flowing around with these guys. And you start to wonder, you know, with the Saudis and the UAE. I mean, there's just, I don't know, there's a lot of stuff flowing through here. And it just seems like it gets more and more layered as we go. But Digby, thanks for unwinding some of this. Go back to watching the Whitaker hearings.
Do I have to?
Well, I need to catch up on it after the show. So I'm going to go read what you've written about it.
But, okay.
As always, thanks so much for your time today, Digby.
Always thanks a pleasure. For having me, Sam. Have a great weekend, everybody.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to candidate for public advocate. We are just days away from the, literally a couple of days away from the end of the period where matching grants, where you can make enough money to get matching grants in the public advocates race, super important. And this is coming also off the heels of a debate the other night. Naomi Kantz is going to join us in just a second.
I
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the former TYT correspondent, the former... Are you still a member of the Unity Commission on for the Democratic Party?
I don't actually think we finished all of our business. It's like there's a DNC meeting every 6 months, and I think we have a couple of things that still need to be voted on. But for the most part, we don't meet anymore. It's not a commission that holds hearings. We published our report, but we haven't, I don't know, adjourned ourselves, I guess.
Well, in that case, then I will introduce you as a current candidate for the public advocate position in New York City with the election just literally, 2 weeks away, right?
Oh, my God, don't freak me out. Yes, it's Tuesday, February 26th.
Ladies and gentlemen, Nomi Konst is joining us. Hello, Nomi. See how I really dragged out that intro.
I liked it. It was good.
All right. Well, so there was a debate. Well, first off, let's just start with this, because this is hugely important. And, you know, I've been talking to people about that. A lot of people don't realize that New York City has one of the best public financing schemes for candidates in the country, where you get, where they will match 8-1 dollar for dollar up to $250, so that big money can't influence it, too dramatically. They will match as long as you get past a threshold of how much in the context of your race.
So for this race, because it's a very unique race, it's a special election. It's $62,500, but to get more technical, you want to overshoot it because people spell their names wrong, they have the wrong address, they say avenue instead of road, and the CFB, the Campaign Finance Board of the city, because this is taxpayer money, they're very strict about this, and people have gotten in a lot of trouble for abusing the system in the past. So we are trying to overshoot and raise about $80,000 in matching funds. But of course, we're receiving donations from all over the country, and,
right,
and we've raised over $125,000. But it's a big deal. As soon as we hit this deadline, we are able to spread our message in these final 2 weeks, which is the time when everyone starts to pay attention.
And so if you're out of if you live outside of New York City, you still give through the link that we have on the majority.fm page. But if you're in New York City, know that if you give $5 up to $250, you can multiply that times 8. And that's how much money Nomi's going to get for her run. And so with that out of the way, you had a debate 2 nights ago. There were, what, mm-hmm, 9 candidates on the stage, at least?
It was a total of 10, 9 others.
And 9 others. And all right, so give me your sense of how that debate went.
You know, it's so funny because I've been debating since I was a kid. Like, it's one of my favorite pastimes. I always feel very different about it. And then I watch it and I see something that's very different than what I felt when I was on stage. I was actually extremely nervous. I'm, going to be completely open and honest. If you weren't a candidate on stage that was nervous, you're probably a sociopath, frankly. But, there's a lot of those in politics. I was very excited to see that online most people said that we won. The press has been a little funny about it because we got almost the most airtime. The only person who got a little bit more than us was the former speaker, Melissa Marks-Favorito, but the feedback on her airtime was not positive. So at the end of the day, I think that we probably did the best in the debate. And the biggest reason is that what separates us from the rest of the candidates on stage is we are not in bed with real estate developers. There's hundreds of thousands of dollars that have been thrown around, possibly millions, actually, in this race, in previous races. People are using developer money in this race from their old accounts. And while all of them were talking about, Band-Aid issues, we were able to get to the heart of it and say, you can't do this if you don't deal with taxing developers. You can't do these things unless you deal with taxing, the Amazon, the tax schemes. And I think that resonated with folks. I called out a lot of folks who've portrayed themselves as progressives in the past, but then I asked questions about why they were aligned with certain financial interests. And, I think that went well. For my part, next one's a couple of weeks, so we'll see how that one goes.
I know this question of taking real estate developer money has been one of the cornerstones of your campaign. And I think anybody who knows New York City politics knows that some of the biggest issues, really, frankly, center around housing, whether, you know, and that bleeds down to the integration of our schools. It bleeds down to the tax base. It bleeds down to who can afford to live in the city. It bleeds down to public transport. So everything sort of is downstream of this question. So I know some of the other candidates, we've had people ask us about this. Why isn't the pledge, I think it is, by the New York Rental Association, why isn't that sufficient as opposed to what you where you have staked your flag on in terms of taking no developer money whatsoever? Why is it not enough to say, I don't take for-profit developer money?
Well, I think, you know, at the end of the day, you see these, I call them I actually said this on stage in the debate, that there's developer philanthropy being given out. So take these rezonings that are happening. There was a little bit of a moment where the former speaker of the city council, Melissa Marks Viverito, I asked her a question. I said, you ran on an anti-gentrification pledge when you first moved to East Harlem and ran for council. But soon after, you started taking developer money and you were part of a developer philanthropy scheme in which you rezoned your neighborhood. But it was in exchange for building these big buildings that are fancy luxury apartments that hand out a couple of affordable apartments in them. And that's not actually preserving affordable housing in New York. That is a partnership that really lets these developers get their tax breaks, and then they throw a little bit of candy to the city. But they're changing the neighborhood. They're making it more expensive for people to rent around those buildings. They're driving up the cost of living. They're driving up the commercial rent costs, and they're not contributing back on top of it. So, you know, this is an old scheme in the city since real estate's been deregulated in the mid-70s, and I think a lot of Democrats have used it as cover because they have some sort of affordable housing plan, but that's just philanthropy. And I think that we need to get off of this, you know, the developer model of they decide how we fund our, you know, the billionaires decide how we fund our city and not the people. And I said the same thing about the MTA. I said, and they said, well, there's this question. Do you think that the governor should control the MTA or the mayor should control the MTA? And I said, well, I think the MTA should be municipalized. I think it should be controlled by the city. You know, when you have political appointees on the board of the MTA, one of which is a developer that doesn't even live in the city, you know, that's determining the lifeblood of the city. That's determining whether or not small businesses are able to afford their rents. You know, there's subway stations that got shut down in Astoria, where I am right now, for over a year and a half. And dozens of businesses had to shut down because those subway stations were shut down just for, the renovations that they had are all just like digital enhancements. It's not actually fixing the MTA. So, you know, we got to get to the heart of it by taking on these developers to get these tax breaks.
All right. And I know you just got a couple minutes here because you got to get to another interview. But lastly, what over the course of this campaign, because we spoke to you about a month or two ago, maybe leading up to this, has your perspective on things changed at all? Are there some things that have become clearer that are more problematic than others as you have dug into this?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to see how the New York City Campaign Finance Board, while we do have a better system, it is still very, very, very hard for candidates who are grassroots to raise the money to be able to not only receive the matching funds, but also to be able to compete on stage. So the debate, you have to not only have gotten on the ballot, not only did you have to raise a certain amount of money, you had to spend a certain amount of money. And that is, I just think it's not very fair for democracy. I mean, sure, you want to make sure that the candidates are viable, but when the limits are as they are, it really does empower those who come from, you know, law firms or developers or, you know, align with certain interests or institutions that can just, you know, your boss says, can you can you bundle $250 checks? And so people who are coming from law firms have the partners of law firms telling their associates to give money, and then very quickly they're able to qualify for matching funds. Whereas our campaign has collected thousands of donations from New York, outside of New York, but you know, it's split in half, just like all the other candidates. But we have way more small dollar donations, way more contributions than all the other candidates, and we have the lowest contribution. That's why it's taking us a little bit longer to get to matching funds. But at the end of the day, these are voters. These are people who are organizing on the streets. These are the people who are going to be voting in this low turnout election. And I think the biggest disappointment is that most people in New York don't even know that they have the public advocate, which is there to represent them, which is there to make sure that their interests are brought to the table against these special interests. And just one more thing to add, if anybody's on the fence here, every single New York City elected official has received developer money. Opponents in this race are playing a lot of tricks right now. They're using like, you know, they're saying like, Nomi, she received $27 from a grandma who rents her basement to her grandson. But at the end of the day, my opponents have received tens of thousands, some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars from the worst pay-to-play real estate developers like the Ratner family. And you don't get that money unless you sit down with the Ratners and you cut a deal. And I think, you know, the press is not really reporting on that fairly. And part of the reason why the press is not reporting on our race, just like they don't report on Bernie Sanders or don't give AOC fair treatment, is because we go against their business model. We got more airtime than anybody else on that stage. And the press, New York Times, barely even mentioned us. So we just have to keep organizing. We have to keep talking to each other. I'm so grateful for your reporting, Sam, because you actually pay attention to the details and follow the money and know your history. And you're not bought by these folks who we really want to take on.
Well, Nomi, I wish you good luck. There's a link at majority.fm if people want to support your campaign. And over and it's Monday. Is that right? Is the deadline for
Monday? Is that the 11th? The 11th. Yes, Monday.
All right. Well, hang in there.
Tell your friends. Tell your family.
All right.
And then afterwards, come volunteer.
Good luck, Nomi. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Sam. Take care.
So, folks. That's the deal. If you live in New York City, you you can donate, I guess. I don't know what the maximum is. It's like $2,000. But $250, the first $250 of that will be matched by the city if you're a New York City resident. And you got to get it in there now. So we have a link. We just tweeted it out. We also have it on the front page of the blog. We'll put it in the YouTube thing. And you donate $5, it's like you're donating $40. You donate $10, it's like you're donating $80. That's right. We can go around. This is just like
winning.
This is
stop.
Honestly,
don't let the math get too complicated.
This is literally what we do at dinner with Mila and Saul.
About donating to Nomiki?
Yeah. Okay. No, with Mila, it doesn't participate. But with Saul, I just keep everything is a math problem for him. He loves math.
Hmm.
And that's probably where we're going to have our biggest fights.
Yeah, I was going to say, because we're pretty editorially opposed to math,
yeah.
I thought.
At one point, I'm just going to be like, if you continue, if you insist on doing these type of algebraic problems.
Right.
You take it out of my
that
house.
That would actually be amazing.
That's not
going to
happen in my house. My house, my rules.
Threaten their
no
kid
math.
About doing math.
No math.
That's awesome. That is a new terrain in child abuse.
Yeah. So, folks, if you are contemplating giving money to Nomi in this public advocate race, do so. And again, you know, for me, I think this came up the other day when we were talking about somebody had asked us about Jumaane Williams. Who I am, you know, broadly speaking, very supportive of, and certainly was in his statewide race. But with all due respect to Nomi, she's a little bit of a bridge burner, and
it's like your highest form of respect for.
Well, yes, but I mean, most people think like, oh, wait, no, but it's true, and like she is willing to, you know, not make friends. In pursuit of what she thinks is the right thing to do. And in the context of this job, I have known some former public advocates before. In fact, we have some we have some former Air America folk who have come into the office, as well as some former Majority Report. Well, one. Yes, one and one. All right. Kelly's here. Dorsey's here. We're going to wait to the fun half to get you guys on camera because I think people haven't seen Dorsey in ages, ever, maybe, on camera. And but we, Dorsey, you were there, right? When we had the, we've had experience with another public advocate. I'm not going to say the name. I'm not going to say the name. All right. I don't want anybody to get turned green with envy because I'm not saying the name. But, and my experience of that guy was, here's a guy who took that job, who's going to do one or two things that are going to look showy, but he's making deals. In fact, he's not even making deals. He's going and having dinner almost multiple times a week with one of the biggest real estate developers in the city, commercial real, his brother. And that's also why his brother was, oh, this is a good place to have my brother sitting in this job, because I'm covered. And this is a problem in the city. So you need somebody who's willing to go in there and say, I know I probably don't have any future in Democratic politics, and therefore I don't need to make friends with certain people. I don't need to be worried about offending certain people. And from my perspective, that's the type of person you want as public advocate in New York City. It is still a relatively new position and is one of those jobs where it will be what the person in the job makes it. And so that's the basis of my support. again, head over to majorityreportradio.com or check out our Twitter feed. You will find a link. Let's take a quick break. Matthew Film Guy is still on the road. What? I know. That's why we're calling him up to find out what the hell is going on. We'll be right back after this.
It's just a bad movie where there's no crying. Handing the keys to me in this red lion. Where the lock that you locked in the suite says there's no prying. When the breath that you breathe in the street screams there's no science. When you look how you look then to me that I cease lying and fall into silence. This is a life story. So there's no climax, no more new territory. So pull away the IMAX. In the slot that you sliced through the scene, there was no shyness. In the plot that you passed through your teeth, there was no pity, no faith.
Ladies and gentlemen, on some Fridays, we play this.
Matthew, the film guy, is choosing your streams. Cast the bettings on Netflix and other such themes. Maybe you'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, please recommend me.
There is. Okay.
You got to get them all.
Matthew Film Guy. Now, when I texted you and asked if you could do this, I thought surely by now Matthew is back from Boca Raton, and yep. He has left the confines of his grandmother's compound there. He has drained everything that could be drained from Tequila Willie's, and he is back in Queens, resuming his duties, anywhere from shooting corporate videos to directing comedy specials or teaching at the JCC Learning Annex elderly folks about film. And yet, no, you're on the world's greatest, longest vacation.
I agree. It has been the greatest vacation. Yeah, and we're wrapping it up here. I made a stop here, and I'm talking to you from wonderful Knoxville, Tennessee, where my sister lives with her husband and my baby niece. So I'm getting in some family time on the way home with Mary and the puppies here. So we're very close to returning. I had to come back by the 12th, which is when my next senior citizens film class starts. You know, I've been working remotely, but that one I got to be there for.
Wait, now, how long have you been gone for? You're already living the democratic socialist dream, aren't you?
I mean, you know, listen, there's a fine line between being freelance and being unemployed, you know, so with the alienation confers freedom, you know, so I've been able to do a little bit of things that people tied down to a job don't have, and I'm going to take advantage of that. Yeah, I'm not going to apologize for that. No
way. Do you force your grandma to watch depressing Scandinavian movies too?
Well, first of all, it's actually my mother, who is now a grandmother herself.
Pardon.
So it does technically fall under that rubric. And no, I don't force her. I did actually watch with my actual grandmother when she was with us. She was into these kinds of films. So she actually took me to see The Crying Game when I was 17. That was an amazing experience.
You went to see The Crying Game with your grandmother?
That's right. Jesus Neither Christ. Of us knew what to expect. And then, boy, were we entertained.
All right.
But, cool as hell.
Boy, were we entertained.
Yeah, I think my grandmother literally jumped out of her seat about 4 feet at the moment of truth in that movie. No spoilers, but it was quite the memorable bonding experience between my grandmother and myself.
Wait, you mean when it turns out they're dreaming?
My mother, she doesn't really care. We Mary and I managed to watch about a movie a day while we were down there, and my mother didn't really join us. She has her own life.
So wait a second. So how long have you been gone?
To see, this is, you know, calendars have just lost all meaning for me at this point. I want to say, I don't know, 6 weeks going on. It will be. We left 3 days before New Year's. So where are we now?
Man. All right.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Don't be too jealous, Sam. You guys have done a lot of good work in my absence there. I've been keeping tabs on you.
I am so jealous. I'm listening to you from the beach. I can't even begin to tell you how jealous I am to have that type of time to just travel around. Now, I'm going to try and fight through my resent and,
at least on this front.
What did you sent me this like a film box? What letter box? What is this?
I believe a couple times ago we talked about how I transcribed my list I had of every single movie
right.
I saw since 1995. Well, this is the social media movie sharing website where you can list those things and follow your friends, and you can see what they're looking at and what they're watching, and it's got reviews, and I haven't done too many of those yet, but it's called Letterboxd, and it's like a social platform for sharing movies that you've watched, and so I just wanted to put it out there to have any chats with other fellow film guys who sometimes find me on Twitter. You can find me on there.
Now, this recent activity, I notice, Won't You Be My Neighbor? Is that you? Did you see the Mr. Rogers movie? What did you think?
That's right. That was one of the ones I caught up on that.
What did you think of that? Did you give that a 4-star? Or is that?
Yeah. Listen, that's one of the ones that's really hard to separate the filmmaking from my emotional connection to the content. I thought it was serviceable filmmaking. I mean, they did a good job kind of laying out kind of the history, and they found a lot of great rare archival footage that I had never seen. But you got to understand, I was definitely raised by Mr. Rogers. So I appreciate it, especially, and as a film guy that I'm trying to like fight this fight about like attention spans and the ability to like see things that aren't like super fast and, you know, multiple cuts per second. His philosophy, I think, really, you know, jibes with mine, you know, that you need to be able to have the attention to absorb certain things. And to the extent that you don't, you miss like entire chunks of what it is to be alive, what it is to be human. So
how much
that
did
sense,
you cry when
really
watching
happy.
This?
You're really saying something,
I mean, two or three times for sure. I mean, you know, sort of tears throughout, but like a few real just like gut punches of just, you know, just because it's like also a sense memory hearing those songs
right,
that I just
right.
remembered, like all the lyrics to. It was like very programmed in my DNA. Like it literally could be the first TV show I ever watched. So that was something. And it's just amazing to see what he was an advocate for. He had a, you know, I didn't realize that he had such a sort of definitive kind of teaching philosophy behind it. You know, his
right.
his sense of rhetoric and what he wanted to put out there, I thought was really sophisticated, which, you know, as a, whatever, a 3-year-old, I couldn't have grasped.
I mean, I agree with that assessment. I didn't think it was such a great movie, but it was pretty sentimental. It was also, the timing of it couldn't be better, right? I mean, it was almost
yes.
released as sort of the antithesis to Donald Trump in some respects.
Has a movie ever made you cry, Sam?
I cry.
Yeah.
Every movie I ever see on an airplane, I cry.
Really?
Like I cry. There's something about
the altitude.
Or something.
There's something about the altitude. Like I remember, what is it? Armageddon? Is that the one with
Liv Tyler
and
Aerosmith?
And who was the other the guy from Die Hard? Bruce Willis. Right.
I have no idea.
Bruce
yeah.
Willis.
Yeah.
Steve Buscemi,
I wept like a baby
on a plane.
That. Yeah. No, it was on a plane. It was Armageddon.
All right.
There's no movie I can see on a plane that I won't cry at.
What about at a lower altitude?
Lower altitude? No.
Okay.
No, I'm not going to cry.
Below sea level.
No, I cry. I cry at movies. I mean, I saw Ralph Wrecks the Internet, and I was very concerned that Ralph was not going to get back.
He wrecks the Internet. That's messing with your business.
Well, he
too,
gets
so.
Back. He gets
Does
back.
That
but
Patreon?
Vanellope, I was afraid, was not going to make it back. And then it was sad. It was sad. I'm not going to lie. It was sad.
Well, I cry at all kinds of things, TV commercials, if they hit the right note. So it's not that, you know, there's crying when you're sentimentally manipulated, you know, and then there's kind of like a more cleansing, deep healing kind of crying. It's
right.
rare to get that one.
I don't get that
But
one.
It's pleasurable to go through the sad feelings of a kind of a sentimental cry thing.
When there was that big Mega Millions and I watched the broadcast of that and I didn't win and I was very upset.
I bet you cried.
I was very upset with
yeah,
that one.
Yeah, I'm sure Donald Trump cries, you know, when something doesn't go his way. He kicks his feet and stamps his feet, you know, that kind of thing. That kind of crying too.
I'm looking at the films here that you've listed. Sicario, that one.
Sicario.
Sorry, you only gave that a 3-star. Now that that is the basis of Donald Trump's fevered dreams about what's happening
so
at the
Sicario
border.
Too.
I think it's a sequel, actually, because I didn't recognize what he was describing yet. Yeah, that was good, just as like a, you know, drug dealer.
Is that a movie I should be watching?
That
sounds like
the first one you would like.
Sicario sounds like that's my kind of movie.
Sicario 2 is not so great.
Yeah, it's just like a well done kind of action movie with some minor political overtones. It's not. It's well done for what it is, but I wouldn't call that like a great movie.
That's my kind of airplane movie. And I'll cry like
yeah,
a baby.
Yeah, you like
it,
well but... done, but not great. That's what that is. I always think of you saying you like Ronin, you know, with De Niro.
Yeah,
like,
it was
right
okay. It was okay. Yeah, not great, but okay. Yeah.
Oh, you're backing away from that one? You're backing away from that
I never
one?
Said
you,
it
you
was great. Was your... I never said it was great, but okay. I definitely said it was worth watching.
Okay, I thought that was like you kept saying to me, send me more movies like that.
Well, yeah, of that genre.
Okay. Okay, that's in there. That one's in there, Sicario.
So do you think Mr. Rogers is a comrade? Because I kind of do.
Well, I was fascinated to hear that he was, I didn't realize he was a minister and that he was a Republican, you know? So those two things I thought were like pretty interesting information. And it didn't mean that he necessarily, like I didn't hear him say like, you know, healthcare is not a right. You know, like he didn't say anything that obvious. And his demeanor in that one
say
famous
all the
hearing where he
access.
Fought for, yeah, access. Access is what's important, kiddies. No, but he's really an old style, you know, conservative where it's like human nature is still something that you respect. You know, you're not trying to corporatize and commodify every child as they come through the school to prison pipeline. So that was shocking. But I think on the, like, would he vote for Bernie? Yeah, I think he probably would vote for Bernie at this stage if he was around.
It's super interesting because I guess one of my DSA comrades had a similar experience to you watching the film, Matthew, and now he's sort of forming the basis of inspiration for this new neighborhood councils project that we're doing to try to kind of combat the atomization that occurs in modern urban life.
Got to build that wall.
Sounds so good. I mean, that's what he was all about. Won't you be my neighbor? You know, joining, you know, connecting with fellow humans. I mean, there was a lot of great examples of stuff in there that I didn't necessarily remember, like the way he kind of normalized the African-American cop as his friend. They put their feet in the pool together. Little subtle nods to just say, like, I'm not going to, you know, hang a lantern on it, as they say, but I'm just going to show these people and things that maybe are controversial in a way that I just feel is comports with my worldview of, like, we're all great. You know, we're all worth something despite, like, what we do.
All right.
And well, you know what? I'll also say I had time on my vacation to listen to the audiobook of a great book that I had read years ago called Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. Do you guys know about this book?
I read that book.
Matt, put this one on your list.
No, I've read that like book. It, Neil Postman actually founded my department that I went to at NYU. The media.
Oh, wow.
Department.
That's fantastic.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Look,
I just feel like Mr. Rogers and
Sam's
he
like,
have a lot
to my board?
Say
I,
about,
want a
like...
I want a pretentious drop.
Okay. There you go.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Get that one in on him while you can. Yeah, I appreciate that. But I want to say, like, I feel like that's kind of what I'm fighting for in these little movie segments we do. Like, the ability to say, like, yes, there's the TV kind of stuff. There's the TV movies. There's entertainment. But we can't lose sight of the value at some point of trying to use your brain in a different and I would consider it deeper kind of more difficult way. You know, I struggle with it, too. If I watched a lot of TV and then I try to watch a movie like Winter Sleep, which is on there by Nuri Bilge Ceylan, which I loved. But the rhythms are really slow. The personal interactions are not necessarily that obvious in the kind of expositional way that you're used to in some of the other shorter form storytelling. So in the same way that Neil Postman kind of decries the death of the written word, I'm here to say, like, these kind of harder movies, you know, call me pretentious or whatever you are. I think it's actually an important thing to fight for, to keep alive, even in some small corner, because it's not like I'm some purist where I don't watch the TV and the kind of trashy movies and so on. But, you know, I'm trying to add into the conversation, like, something is lost by the inability to concentrate on something for more than 30 seconds.
Wow. What was that?
Exactly.
I couldn't help myself.
Exactly.
Now,
sorry.
Hello. Well,
hi.
I got to tell you, Matthew, that's all well and good. I'm sort of convinced, though, that recorded stuff is over. We peaked. It's done. It's about to wrap
up.
I'm now only live theater.
Only live theater.
Yep. That's it for me.
Good for you, Sam. Good for you. You can afford that. That's great.
Benjamin paid for me. Benjamin took me.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Now I
put that Arby's money to good use.
Exactly. I went to go see True West last night. And
oh, you lucky. That's my favorite play. I'd have
now,
to say American, at least, favorite play.
It's funny because I don't see a lot of theater, but I did, and I didn't realize it. Ben was like, let's go see True West. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he's like, the play.
Oh, boy.
And I'm like, oh, okay, yes. And our friend Gary Wilms is in it. There's only four people in the play.
Yeah.
And
is it an O'Neill play? Who wrote it?
No, Shepard.
Sam Shepard.
I have no idea.
And
Malkovich and Sinise did the kind of quintessential PBS TV version.
And that's what Malkovich made Malkovich, really.
Yeah.
But I saw the Philip Seymour Hoffman O'Reilly version.
John C. Reilly. I saw that one, too.
In the round.
Do you remember who was playing who in that one? Because they switched roles.
Yeah, they switched every night. I don't remember. In fact, I barely had remembered that I had seen it. And then we were walking to the play last night. Wait a second. I've seen this before in the round or three quarters, I guess it was. And I don't know who I went with or when it was. It was probably 20 years ago. And
2000, I think it was.
Yeah. So I don't remember any of it. But I saw the version last night. It was okay. Ethan Hawke and then this other dude. And
Paul Dano.
Yeah.
You should occasionally write short reviews. Not... That could be good for them.
Well,
yeah.
I don't...
It was okay. There was Ethan Hawke and someone else. But
I thought I didn't see it before, but I thought.
Benjamin paid my ticket, but I liked John Malkovich years ago.
Ethan
Thank you. That's my review.
Ethan Hawke was good.
Sorry.
That guy, Paul Dano, apparently he's very good in some movie.
Dan Bongino?
He's in the Escape from...
Elmira.
Elmira. Is that what it is? Escape from...
Danamora.
Danamora.
Everybody loves that show. I haven't seen it.
I need to see that. That was my beat for a while at Death and Taxes, by the way, writing about the big dicked fugitive.
Oh, I had no idea about any of what you're talking about. I missed all of
that. Yeah, that was a weird
story. Quite the story.
But I don't know. I didn't find I'm not going to get too deep into this, but I wasn't blown away.
By all means.
By the acting. Sometimes, you know, you got to have something under the hood.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, I know what you mean. That sums it up.
If you don't have anything under the hood.
Paul Dano was in Okja, though. Dano was in Okja, the movie about the pig I recommended a few times ago. So
movies are different.
Good work.
Movies are different than doing a play.
Course, yeah.
It's different.
Yeah.
And
that should be the column you write.
Movies are different.
Movies different. I see.
Movies are different. So Matthew,
so
Frum,
right,
guy, you go from Boca Raton to where are you in Knoxville, Tennessee?
Well, we went up the west coast of Florida to visit some old friends from film school in Sarasota first, then
Pensacola. Did you go to
Clearwater?
Pensacola?
No, we drove past it. We drove past it, but stopped in Sarasota. Went up to Tampa or Clearwater, really. Then a little bit more inland, Zephyr Hills. A friend of Mary's that we know was there. And then we drove up here to Knoxville. So we did a couple days, you know, as we drove up.
Is Clearwater the Scientology place?
You're living the life, Matthew.
It's great. We got like our Mazdas, like our Conestoga. It all fits in there, you know. It's good square footage. And everything we need is one rest stop away, really.
Oh,
ooh,
God.
Did you visit that town with all the psychics, Casadega?
Whoa, no. Oh my God! How did we miss that? That would have been that's like catnip to Mary. Where's that?
You gotta go back. It's somewhere in Florida, I believe. There was a Bright Eyes album named after it, which is why I know about it.
You could
take a few more days.
Okay, and that's why I don't. Probably.
You could have had all your answers to this interview already answered, and you wouldn't have.
Where's the fun in that?
Imagine the psychic. Then Sam will say he didn't see the movie.
Yeah, what?
Then he'll complain about his sleep schedule.
Now, Matthew, film guy, was there anything adventurous, or was it just, we just drove around Florida and saw some people we knew and then went to Knoxville? Or was there any, I don't know, did you get into a fight with a trucker at a truck stop? Did you,
No, we brought our two dogs into every establishment that we visited and met with mostly approving stares. Our two dogs, Dudley and Mabel, they basically come with us everywhere. And I think that was the most adventurous thing we had. Like, we'd be outside like, is this place going to be cool? Let's go in and find out. And we're just like, we barge in and people go like, oh, cute dogs. And then we're like, okay, great. That worked.
Now, are you going to like Piggly Wiggly's? They got Piggly Wiggly's down there?
No. They have Publix and Winn-Dixie, I think. We draw the line at the grocery store. We know they're not wanted there.
Oh, all right. Because the Piggly Wiggly, that is a fun. That's.
I don't
best.
Know. I know Publix.
They're just basically like Stewart's up in, I guess they got them in New York, or Cumbie's.
Oh, okay.
Cumberland.
Oh,
Farms,
like a Cumbie's. I know
in,
Cumbie's.
In Massachusetts,
of course, Cumbie's.
But Piggly Wiggly's.
You know, we did watch Mary and I did watch a Mississippi Burning, and so it made us a little paranoid driving through the South. You know, like we. Hey, Jew boy, who you got there with you?
I thought you were Southern Jewry, Matthew.
There is. Absolutely is. But, you know, like we're driving through some of these more, let's say, remote areas on the highway going up there. So, you know, we try to just play it cool.
All right. But
speed
nothing
limit,
like that went down.
Limit.
That's too bad. That would have been an interesting story.
Yo, I'm so sorry to disappoint you. I didn't spend a night in like a county jail. You know,
I'm sorry to hear that. I am very sorry to hear that. All right.
Next time I will commit some low level felony.
I have no doubt that you did. I just don't think that you got caught. I just want to make that.
Comment.
I want to clarify on that. Now, film guy Matthew, now that you're, I know that you've been in vacation mode, but
I have been doing. let me just say, I have been doing some work on the great Ted Alexandro's podcast, A Little Bit Me, which I urge everyone to go to iTunes and check out if they want to hear the insider view from this comedian.
All this guy does is ever talk about Ted Alexandro. Jesus Christ.
Well, he's the guy I'm working for right now, so let me pump a little bit. I thought you respected the game, Michael.
I do respect the game. That's a fair point. All right. Talk about him more.
Yeah.
I stand corrected.
Yeah. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say. I just wanted to put that out there. Because
Michael wants to know where his Vig is.
Right.
Anyways, so what? All right.
We'll talk about it.
What?
So I've been doing that.
Okay. What would you like to recommend to us to view? I'm going to put it right
okay,
into
so
my
here,
from
here,
Denmark.
In the vein,
it's incest and capitalism. All right, sorry. Go ahead. I jumped the gun.
I would see that movie in a heartbeat.
I know you would.
Oh, dude, do you know? Wait a second. Do you know there's an Elaine May Film Festival going on up here?
I do. I'm missing it. I've seen all the movies already, but I would go see it in a heartbeat. She's definitely one of my all-time favorites.
Okay.
Listeners of this segment have probably heard me mention her a lot. It's must-see stuff.
Okay.
A New Leaf.
Well, I don't want you to talk about
Heartbreak Kid.
Just
Mikey and Nikki is probably my all-time favorite movie of any kind.
That's great.
Also, Ishtar, and then some of the more sort of obscure ones.
Okay.
Say again.
Okay. So, your movie recommendation of the week. We got to get going.
Okay. I want everyone to go see one of the great war films of all time. It's harrowing. It's brutal. It's sort of surreal. It's
Thin Red Line.
It's called Come and See by L.M. Klimov. If I'm saying his name right. And it was made in 1985, and it's basically about the Nazis' brutal march through Belarus and the kind of partisans that fought back there. And it's told through the point of view of a 13-year-old boy who starts off saying, like, I'm going to go defend my village. And then within the first 10 minutes, his village is, like, brutally massacred. And it's just so batshit crazy. It's told in a semi kind of documentary style, but a little bit of the sort of Tarkovskian moving camera, slow cinema style, but intermittently just like totally surreal and really just like shocking. Come and see. It's a Russian film and it's available streaming on Vudu, but it's also available on DVDs everywhere and all your alternate film websites.
Vudu. Okay. All right. There it is. February, it's release date, 1987. It was first released in New York by L.M. Klimov. All right, great. Well, Matthew Film Guy, want to wish you a safe journey home for the rest of your trip, and I hope that it gets, you know, I hope it's not too much longer. It really is annoying that you're driving around for 7-8 weeks, just cruising around.
You can relax. I'll be home on Monday, so I'll
right.
be back there.
I appreciate
my
that.
Ass off with the best with all of you.
All right,
Ted
well,
Alexandra
you missed a really
needs
cool.
you, man.
Yeah, Matthew Film Guy, always a pleasure.
Same here, guys. Take care.
Okay, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will have more fun. We have some video of Candace Owen apparently. Had some comments on nationalism and Hitler.
Mm.
I'm sure that were quite measured and learned.
That.
Yes, I'm interested in seeing that and hearing that. Also, we have some. Brandon Straka is going to run against AOC. That's going to be very exciting.
He's the one person.
I'm so torn between not wanting to reward him with attention.
One
and like,
person.
Please do that. Please do that.
He also said a fringe left-wing train is infiltrating the government,
right.
And he's the only one that can reverse it.
Right. That's another questionable word choice.
It's definitely a mixed metaphor.
Yeah,
definitely
that's a mixed metaphor, to say the least. But he does, in his own words, choose his words very consciously.
He's the only one who's going to stop that.
Yeah. He's a
poet. He's got a creative lexicon, all right?
Let's apathetically steamroll over that in the fun half.
And Sean Spicer
is drunk.
Finally
is
gets on television
lit.
Completely
Spicer.
Wasted.
He is lit.
Oh, we got a lot to talk about. And more, we will take your phone calls. We may take your IMs. Of course, it's Friday. We're going to run out of time soon.
Oh, very much
and, so. And don't forget, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com for just pennies a day. You can support this program and also get the Fun Half content. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. MajorityReportRadio.com. You will also find the link to Nomi Kant's to support her run for public advocate in New York. Not much time to do so. And Michael, today is Friday, which means that the beginning of the week was Monday, and the day that follows that is Tuesday. However, this week, the Michael Brooks Show was on Thursday.
Right. And it was a great show with Breonna Joy Gray and Jeffrey Halper. Check it out. You can watch the whole thing at the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. And, of course, get the whole thing at patreon.com/TMBS.
Jamie?
Yeah, so this week on the Antifada, we did a collaborative episode with some of our...
Crossover.
No, because it wasn't a crossover. It was just a bunch of our excellent listeners, most of whom have been with us since the beginning, who came into the studio and helped us make a pretty cool episode with their own conspiracy theories about the various things, various parts of American life that Vladimir Putin is messing with and subverting democracy around.
I can't believe that was this week. I feel like that happened like four weeks ago.
It's because we took some time off in the middle and we did a live stream and it's been very intense. Also, on Monday, we're dropping a bonus for all of our patrons, all of our treasured patrons. Andy is still in Mexico and he caught up with Blair Taylor of the Institute for Social Ecology at Puerto Vallarta Bear Weekend, which is exactly what it sounds like, wherein they talked about Murray Bookchin, the libertarian socialist experiment happening in Rojava, and the growing network of radical municipalism building counterpower in the U.S.
That is not what it sounds like.
Oh, I mean, I guess it depends what you think about when you hear the word bear. I think of like a bunch of big hairy gay men having a party.
Oh, I thought it was literally bears. I don't know, but that's what, when someone says, oh, no, it is what it sounds like. Oh, okay, bears.
Apparently, Murray Bookchin is huge in the bear community.
Who'd have thunk it? Who Murray Bookchin is.
Google him.
Okay, I will Google this.
I know you don't like the term libertarian socialist, so I'll call him an anarcho-communist instead.
Thank you.
Very influential.
Matt?
Literary Hangover. Coming soon, I think next week, will be The Unparalleled Adventures of One Hans Fall by Edgar Allan Poe, which is maybe one of the first sci-fi stories ever.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Edgar Allan Poe may have started sci-fi as well as starting detective fiction.
Is that right?
Yep.
And are you working for anybody who might want to promote this guy, Edgar Allan Poe?
Because
I hear he's coming back.
He is.
Everybody's talking about him. More and more people have
been recognizing him.
And I'm just trying to hitch my trailer to that bandwagon, I guess.
It reminds me to send out the Majority Report contributor disclosure forms. Make sure you're not promoting something that you're getting kickbacks from.
Thank you, Kelly.
Or you're not promoting something that you don't get kickbacks from. Kelly, you what?
She's a big Literary Hangover fan.
Yeah, that's what he was just talking about, the Literary Hangover.
Oh, yeah, okay. She's actually a patron of mine.
Wow.
Very nice, Kelly. Very nice.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Also on the show, maybe we'll get Kelly and Dorsey to say hello. Generations collide. This is like a... like a weird... generation
feels like the last show ever.
Yeah, this is it. All right, folks.
Bender too.
Hopefully, we'll be here on Monday, we should be. All right, quick break. Headed to the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back after this.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.